Thank you, Brother John, and good afternoon, brethren, and we're very happy to have this opportunity to be with you this afternoon and consider with you an incident found in the Lord's Word, which we think is not only very interesting, but contains some valuable lessons for us. We'd like to first bring you the love and greetings of the remainder of the Phoenixville Ecclesia. They send their love and greetings to you. The three faithful servants of the Lord, which our chairman mentioned, are mentioned by name in Daniel 3:16. We're going to read Daniel 3:16 through 18, and I'm sure you will immediately recognize the occasion that we're going to discuss with you this afternoon. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. As we said, the occasion is very well known. All of Daniel, the third chapter, describes the scene. We're not going to read the whole chapter. We think you're generally familiar with it, but we will just try to review the situation briefly. Nebuchadnezzar had set up a huge golden image. He called together his princes, his governors, captains, judges, counselors, and was going to have a dedication ceremony to this golden image or statue which he had set up. And he had given the command that at the given signal, all those present should bow down and worship the image. And he attached a penalty for not doing so. Anyone who would not bow down and worship the golden statue was to be cast into a burning fiery furnace. Now this event, Brother Russell estimated this event took place approximately 20 years after Daniel and the three Hebrews were taken captive into Babylon. Smith's Bible Dictionary pretty closely agrees with this. The Septuagint translation says that this event in Daniel 3:1 occurred in the 18th year of Nebuchadnezzar. During those 18, 20 years, or whatever it was, Daniel and the three Hebrews were coming into positions of prominence. They had reached positions of leadership in the government. They were in positions of authority. Now, the image Nebuchadnezzar set up, we said, was very large. Daniel 3:1 gives the size of it. It says, whose height was 70 cubits, and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. Zondervan's Bible Dictionary says a common cubit is slightly less than 18 inches. Now, Smith's Bible Dictionary says there are various cubits given in the Bible, and they range in length anywhere from 18 to 25 inches. Now, if we use the smaller figure, 18 inches, as the length of a cubit, this would make this golden image 90 feet high. Quite a large statue. By way of comparison, most of you are familiar with the Statue of Liberty in New York Harbor. That's about 150 feet high. So it's not as big as that. But nevertheless, 90 feet high would be, I would estimate, approximately the height of an 8- or 9-story building, which is quite a large statue. It could probably be seen from some distance. It was located in an area where it wasn't a mountainous area, it was rather flat land, and this would make it more visible for a longer distance. Now, Daniel 3:1 says it was an image of gold. We don't know that it was solid gold. If it was solid gold, that would have taken an immense amount of gold, as you can well imagine, a statue 90 feet high and 9 feet wide. It may have been hollow, or it may have been gold overlaid over a base of clay. We don't really know. But it was gold on the outside. It appeared to be gold. What was the image to represent? Again, turning to Smith's Bible Dictionary, it quotes Nebuchadnezzar as referring to the god Bel-Merodach as the great lord, the senior of the gods, and the most ancient. Now, in the photodrama, Brother Russell suggests the image was intended to represent Nebuchadnezzar himself. But in another reprint article, page 4873, Brother Russell suggests that the image represented Nebuchadnezzar in that it represented the god that he worshipped. And the god that he worshipped was Bel-Merodach. It was located, what Daniel 3:1 says, was the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Now, scholars are not sure today exactly where the plain of Dura is. It must have been either in or near the city of Babylon, we believe. Brother Russell, one place, suggests that it was near the center of the walled city of Babylon and could be seen from any part of that city. That may or may not be the case, but it would be visible for some distance. Now, what kind of a man was Nebuchadnezzar who would do something like this, set up an image and make such a requirement with such a severe penalty for disobedience? Well, he was an absolute ruler and one who would not tolerate disobedience at all. He was also a successful military leader. He had conquered many lands. He had conquered Israel. He was also a man who appreciated beauty. He made Babylon a very beautiful place, one of the 7 wonders of the world. He was also a proud man, we believe. He was proud of his accomplishments. He was proud of his military victories. And he was proud of the beauty he had established in Babylon. He was also superstitious, a worshiper of idols. I believe he was also a man who attended to extremes. He set up this extreme requirement and attaching such an extreme penalty for disobedience. And then, if we read further on to the end of the 3rd chapter of Daniel, after God had delivered the 3 Hebrews out of the fiery furnace, Nebuchadnezzar went to the other extreme. In Daniel 3:29, he says, "Therefore I make a decree that every people, nation, and language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made a dunghill, because there is no other God that can deliver after this sort." So we see he still didn't have the spirit of the Lord. He now had respect for the Lord because he saw what the Lord had done for these 3 Hebrews, but he still didn't have the spirit of the Lord. Now he was going to the other extreme of intolerance. Anyone who would say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, a terrible thing was to be done to them. We see this spirit of intolerance has also been characteristic of antitypical Babylon through much of the gospel age. Now, what motivated Nebuchadnezzar to do something like this? Well, Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom was composed of various nations, and these various nations worshiped various gods. And very likely, he wanted to bring these various peoples into one harmonious whole, all worshiping the same God. And he reasoned, if he could get them all united along religious lines, he would have better control over them. He worshiped the god Bel-Merodach. He believed this god had given him the victories over the various nations that he conquered. And so this was the god that everyone should worship. Also, we think that Nebuchadnezzar may have remembered the dream that he had had, the dream that Daniel interpreted for him, in which he saw a great image, the head of which was gold. And this was all he was concerned with, the head of gold, because Daniel said, "Thou art this head of gold." And so he made his whole image of gold. Possibly the dream may have been an influence upon him. As we said, he was also a proud man, proud of his accomplishments. And so he made a great festival to celebrate. Being of gold, the image must have been very beautiful, must have been really outstanding in appearance. And if the people associated him with this god, they would be very likely to obey him. Now notice how these characteristics compare with the spirit of papacy, the antitypical Babylon through much of the gospel age. Proud of their accomplishments, thinking that God has given them, some sort of a god has given them a victory, worshiping of idols, making great festivals, appreciating great beauty, and setting up very beautiful things, beautiful outward beauty. Now, what do we know about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Well, they were among the Israelites Nebuchadnezzar had taken captive. At the time of the captivity, we read in Daniel 1:4 that certain ones of the Israelites were selected for special positions. Those selected were, we quote, "children in whom was no blemish, but well-favored and skillful in all wisdom and cunning and knowledge and understanding science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans." Daniel 1:7 also tells us that their original names were not Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, but rather Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. In Daniel 2, verses 48 and 49, we are informed that Daniel was made the chief of the governors of Babylon, and that it was at Daniel's request that these three were set over the affairs of Babylon, evidently as governors of the various provinces. We think they were men of great ability. They were obviously men of great courage, and they were men of great reverence and trust in the Lord. How do they happen to have such great courage and reverence and trust for the Lord? Was this something they suddenly developed on this occasion? We don't think so. We think they were developing this all along in their experiences in Babylon. Very early in their experiences in Babylon, they had exercised a faithfulness to the Lord in much smaller things than this. In Daniel 1:8 to 16, we read that along with Daniel, they rejected the king's meat and drink in favor of a very plain diet, which would be more in harmony with the law of the Lord. They had been under Daniel's influence and guidance and example. And being careful to obey God in these little things resulted in what we read in Daniel 1:17. "As for these four children, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams." And there's a good lesson for us in this. We cannot expect to conquer in large trials when they come upon us, unless we are doing our best in the little everyday affairs of life. And this is the best way we can prepare for hard trials that might yet be in our future. We think it's also noteworthy that the prosperity that these three, along with Daniel, enjoyed did not make them careless of their duties and their responsibilities to the Lord. Most of us today are rather prosperous. Compared to many peoples in the world, we are practically living in luxury. And how is that prosperity affecting us? Are we taking it for granted? Is it making us careless as to our responsibilities to the Lord? We each have to answer this for ourselves. But it's a good lesson. The three Hebrews weren't affected in that way. They continued on as faithful to the Lord through their prosperity as they were in their hour of trial. And they were put to the test, as is shown in today's lesson. Would they be willing to lose their good positions in Babylon? Would they be willing to lose even their lives simply to obey God? Would they be willing to be considered ungrateful to Nebuchadnezzar for what he had done for them by spoiling his festival? Are we willing to do anything that the Lord requires of us? Are we willing to lose our present prosperity or measure of it as the case may be? Are we willing to even lose our lives should the Lord require? Now, Nebuchadnezzar didn't want to kill Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They were faithful servants. They were good governors. He didn't want to lose them. And so when it was reported to him that they had not bowed down in obedience to his command, well, he was angry, but he was going to give them another chance. He called them in and he talked to them. We don't think the whole conversation is recorded, but we might suppose that he reminded them that the gods had not delivered the nations out of his hand. Indeed, their God, whom they worshipped, had not delivered Israel out of his hand. Why should they expect that same God to deliver them out of his hand now? He might have reminded them, though, I can't tolerate you disobeying my command. You, governors of the provinces, all the people will take note of this, and they will assume that they can disobey my commands too. And how did the three Hebrews respond? Did they try to reason with him, persuade him, or argue with him? No, they didn't. He was angry. He wasn't in a frame of mind to be persuaded. They simply stated their position. We will not bow down. God is able to deliver us, and he can, and he will. But if he won't, we still will not bow down. They expressed confidence in God, but also determination to obey him. When Nebuchadnezzar saw their determination, he didn't wait to give them another chance. Instead, he ordered the furnace to be heated 7 times hotter than ever before. We don't know exactly what 7 times hotter is, but we assume it means as hot as they could heat it. This shows the unreasonableness of a man who is in a rage. He evidently forgot that by heating the furnace that much hotter, it would only decrease their suffering, because it would bring about their death that much quicker. We don't know too much about the furnace itself. It has been suggested that it was possibly fueled by petroleum, since oil wells have been found in that area, and also that the furnace may have been the one that was used to melt the gold to make the image. The furnace must have been very large. It must have been large enough for 4 men to walk around inside. And it seems as though the three Hebrews were cast into it from the top and fell down. For Daniel 3:23 reads, "And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down into the midst of the burning fiery furnace." And then in Daniel 3:25, "Lo, I see 4 men walking loose. 4 men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and the fourth was like the Son of God." And we believe that was the Logos, Jesus. Now, what was accomplished by this incident? What was the effect on those present and who saw it? It was quite a witness, we believe, to those who looked on. We have no doubt that during those 20 years, if it was 20 years, that the three Hebrews were in Babylon, they weren't silent about their God. They no doubt had told others about their God and about the great things he had done for their people in times past, and maybe perhaps some of his promises for the future. And perhaps they told the Babylonians these things with very little effect. But now the Babylonians could see for themselves what this God was able to do and what an effect that would have on the words that they had already spoken. What an impressive lesson this must have been. And what a lesson it must have been for the Israelites who were there and witnessed it. Remember, during the years prior to the captivity, idolatry was one of the chief sins of Israel. And it's very interesting to note whether or not it's related that after the captivity, we find comparatively little said about Israel's idolatry. It seems that idolatry was no longer their chief concern as it was prior to the captivity. Perhaps this lesson had a great effect upon them. What did it do for the three Hebrews themselves? It certainly demonstrated their faith and obedience, and really gave them reason to trust the Lord even greater in the future. Consider the pressure that was placed upon these three. I don't know how you think of it, but I usually think of it that the three were all together on this occasion, and they got together and they talked it over and decided, no, this would be wrong to bow down to this image. We will not do it. Now, it may not have been that way. They were governors, we believe, probably of separate provinces, and maybe they weren't even together on this occasion. Maybe one was in one area, one was somewhere else, and maybe independently each of them decided, I will not bow down. This would have been even more difficult than for the three of them to have been together and discussed it and stood together. Did you ever ask yourself, and this is one of the main points of our lesson, what would you have done if you had been in their position? What would I have done? What would you have done? Did they have any alternatives? Well, we think they did have some alternatives. Not good alternatives, but possibilities anyway. They knew what was being planned. They could have tried to find a place to hide and just hope nobody would discover them and nobody noticed that they hadn't bowed down and worshipped the image. Or they could have bowed down and pretended to worship the image, but not doing so in their hearts. Just simply bow down and pretend to do like everybody else, but this doesn't mean anything. I'm just bowing down to the ground. And the Lord knows that I'm not really worshiping this image. And he understands the circumstances, and I can't serve him if I'm cast into this fiery furnace. So the Lord will make an allowance. They might have done that. Or they might have just stooped down or lain down on the ground and not really bowing down to the image and, again, hope that nobody would notice them. Or they could do as they did, refuse to bow down and simply ignore the order and suffer the consequences. What would you have done? Some of us would probably, well, I think for myself, I'll say first, I'm not sure what I would have done. I doubt that very many of us are really sure what we would have done if actually in those circumstances. I know what I hope I would have done. I hope I would have done what the three Hebrews did. But what would you have done? We'd like to think that we would do as they did. We know that's the right thing to do. Some of us, without hesitation, would say, well, I know that's what I would have done. But before we're too overconfident, remember the Apostle Peter. Remember Peter the night before Jesus died? Jesus told his disciples, all of you will forsake me. And Peter vowed and he swore he was absolutely sure, though everyone else would forsake thee, I will never leave thee. I'm ready to even die for thee. And what happened? He was put to the test. And what did he do? He denied that he even knew who the Lord was, that he even knew him. When he was put to the test, he wasn't as strong as he thought. And so, what would we have done? It's probable that most of us will never be tried in exactly this same way. And yet most of us are being put to the test in small ways daily. And how are we passing these small tests? How are we tested? We're tested in various ways. If we work in an office or a factory, we're tested sometimes by things which our job seems to require us to do, and things which might go against our conscience to do, which we realize are wrong to do. But we just go along and do it and think, well, the Lord understands I have to work for a living, I have to do this even though I'm not in harmony with it. Or do we draw the line and say, this is wrong, I will not do it? Even if we're not employed in that way, we are faced with situations where perhaps our honesty is tested, our sincerity, our integrity. We might go shopping and the store clerk makes a mistake and gives us too much change. And we might reason, well, they overcharge for that item anyway. It's only a few cents. I might as well keep it because the store is making plenty of money and their prices are too high to begin with. And we might rationalize it like that. But it's not really honest. If we know they've made a mistake, we should return the money. Do we try to conceal our truth activities from our friends and neighbors because, well, they won't understand and they'll think we're sort of foolish and maybe they'll make fun of us? One test which comes in some of our lives, which is a little bit closer to what the three Hebrews were subjected to, is the test of military service in time of war. And we notice here, too, there are sometimes alternatives. I believe there was a CO meeting at this convention discussing that possibility. We might become a religious conscientious objector, refusing any war-related activity. We think this would correspond to the course that the three Hebrews took. They wouldn't compromise in any sense of the word. Or another alternative, we might say, well, I will accept non-combatant service, but I won't take a weapon and go into combat and kill my fellow man. Well, we might compare this to trying to hide and hope we won't be noticed. And why do we say this? We think to take non-combatant service is risky. It might work out, but it might not. In time of war, one who is in non-combatant service might find himself in a very difficult situation, one in which he was very much tempted to actually engage in the combat, or one in which some of those around him would be almost demanding that he do so and making it very difficult for him if he didn't, maybe even depending on him for his help. Or we might take another alternative. We might say, well, I won't bear arms, but I'll work in a war plant making war material. We might compare this to bowing down and pretending to worship, but really in our heart not doing so. And we might rationalize our working in the war plant by saying, well, I need a job, I have to earn a living some way, and I know what I'm making is guns or ammunition or something like that, but I have no control with what others do with those things after they're made, and the Lord knows I'm not in harmony with the way they're being used. So I just trust that the Lord will understand and make allowance. Which alternative will we choose if we're faced with that decision? Each one in that position must decide for himself just as the three Hebrews had to decide for themselves. But they didn't choose the easiest alternative. And notice how they chose. They chose on the basis of obedience to God. Upon what basis are we making our decisions daily? Is obedience to God our prime and first consideration? Notice the three Hebrews weren't sure that God was going to deliver them. They said, "Our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us, but if not, we will not serve thy God." And so our God hasn't promised to always deliver us in the flesh. We might think, well, we're going to take a stand on this matter, whatever it is, on the basis of obedience to God, truth or righteousness, and I'm sure God is going to make it work out the way I'd like it. Well, that may not be the case. He hasn't promised to make it work out for our fleshly interests in all cases. But are we willing to obey anyway, even if God doesn't overrule it for our fleshly interests? If we could choose how God is going to test us, we'd probably choose the ways in which we think it would be easiest. The three Hebrews were tried along the lines of idolatry. We're sometimes tried along this line too. Idols are not always just statues that men bow down to. One definition of an idol, and this is from Webster: any object of ardent or excessive devotion or admiration is an idol. Any object of ardent or excessive devotion or admiration. With that definition, an idol can be almost anything. It can be money, can be our home, can be our automobile, clothing, jewelry, any material possession that we might have can be an idol if it is an object of excessive devotion or admiration. Are we bowing down to any of these things? Figuratively speaking, are we devoting too much attention to these things? Or an idol might be a person. It might be our husband or wife. It might be our children. It might be another brother or sister or a friend or any acquaintance that we think very highly of. Are we bowing down to any of these? Are we compromising principles of the truth for the favor of any of these? Are they an object of excessive devotion or admiration? If we are rejecting or compromising the word of the Lord, the principles of the truth, to gain the favor of any of these, it is like bowing down to an idol. Sometimes refusing to bow down will bring suffering, persecution, or at least the threat of it. And it was so in the case of the three Hebrews. They demonstrated their willingness to suffer for righteousness if it was required. And they were delivered. But promises of physical deliverance are not given to Christians. Rather, God promised just the opposite, that faithfulness would result in persecution. 2 Timothy 3:12, all who will live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution. Are you willing to suffer as the three Hebrews were willing? They were delivered miraculously. Some of the faithful ones in the past were delivered miraculously, and some were not. Remember, Peter was delivered from prison miraculously, but around the same time, James was killed. Paul was spared on numerous occasions, whereas Stephen was stoned to death. Hebrews 11, verses 33 through 35 speak of those who subdued kingdoms, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword because of their faith. And then in the next verses, verses 35 through 38, it speaks of others who likewise, because of their faith, were tortured, endured cruel mockings and scourgings, bonds and imprisonment, and were stoned. How much are we willing to suffer? Do we have the same trust in the Lord as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Brother Russell suggests that the protection of these three in the fire may illustrate how God may protect his people in the time of trouble. God didn't prevent the three from being cast into the fiery furnace, but he did prevent them from being injured. But he was dealing with them as natural men. With us, he is dealing as new creatures. He prevented them from being physically injured. With us, he prevents us from being spiritually injured. And we believe it is thus that Luke 21, verses 34 to 36 may be fulfilled. And take heed to yourselves, lest at any time your hearts be overcharged with surfeiting and drunkenness and cares of this life, and so that day come upon you unawares. For as a snare shall it come on all them that dwell on the face of the whole earth. Watch ye therefore, and pray always, that ye may be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass, and stand before the Son of Man. We do not escape the cares of this life. We have the cares of this life. They are all around us. But with the Lord's help and our trust in him, they won't be able to harm us spiritually. They may harm us physically, but not spiritually. We too may have fiery trials, but the Lord may not prevent the trial. It was pointed out to us this morning in the connection with the diamonds that the trials are very necessary. But the Lord will be with us in the midst of the trial, just as he was with the three Hebrews in the fiery furnace. And along with the trial, and sometimes as a result of the trial, comes a blessing. It was so in the case of the three. So when trials come upon us, let us trust that the Lord is supervising for our best spiritual interests. Be assured also of his power to make all things work together for our good, to overrule the situation. Sometimes in the middle of a trial, we can't really see how God can work it all out for our own good. We really can't see a way out. Sometimes the situation seems just impossible. Imagine how it seemed to the three Hebrews. There was Nebuchadnezzar. He had given his command. He wasn't going to compromise it. Absolutely, this is what is required. There was the furnace, heated 7 times hotter. Nebuchadnezzar was determined. They were equally determined. They weren't going to compromise. The situation seemed hopeless. How could they possibly be delivered? But God found a way. The soldiers were there, ready to seize them and cast them into the furnace. But still, God found a way to deliver them. To the human mind, the situation was totally impossible. Are your circumstances and mine more difficult than those of those three on that occasion? I'm sure they're not. Our deliverance in trial is not always as spectacular as this. Neither is it always a physical deliverance. And yet the same power that was able to deliver the three Hebrews out of the fiery furnace is operating on our behalf for our best spiritual interests in any trial that we may have. Now, there's still one other aspect of this subject we want to mention just briefly. In reprints on page 2495, as I believe also in other cases, Brother Russell suggests certain parallels or correspondences between literal Babylon and symbolic Babylon, as it is stated in Revelation. One of these suggestions is that in literal Babylon, there was Nebuchadnezzar and his image of Daniel 3, and in symbolic Babylon, there is the beast and his image in Revelation 13. The faith and obedience of the three Hebrews were put to the test by Nebuchadnezzar and his image in Daniel 3, literal Babylon. The Lord's people are to be put to the test by symbolic Babylon, the beast and his image in Revelation 13. In Revelation 13:15, we read that, and that refers back to the two-horned beast, and he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. We believe the image of the beast had its beginning with the Evangelical Alliance of Protestant denominations back in 1846. We don't think it has ceased to exist, but it still exists today. During the time of its existence, the Lord's people are being tested in some ways similarly to the three Hebrews. Would they bow down to the image of the beast? Will they bow down and worship the image? The promised reward to the overcomers is to those who will not bow down. Revelation 20, verse 4. And I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given unto them. And I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus and for the word of God, and which had not worshipped the beast, neither his image, neither had received his mark in their foreheads or in their hands. And they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. Worshipping the image of the beast, we don't think, is merely a literal bowing down. We believe worshiping the image of the beast can be a mental assent to the doctrines of the image of the beast, to the practices and authority of the image of the beast. This would correspond, we believe, to receiving the mark in the forehead. Worshipping the image of the beast can also be a lending of support in some manner to the image of the beast. And this would be the mark in the right hand. Now, in Brother Russell's day, it was somewhat difficult for a sincere Christian to stand separate from so-called Orthodox churches. We believe it was more difficult for a sincere Christian to do that in Brother Russell's day than it is today. Today, there have been many splits in Christendom. And there is more tolerance to differences of opinion due to less emphasis on doctrine. Not that the truth is becoming popular. We don't mean to say that at all. But, well, the various churches have been pretty fragmented themselves in their beliefs, and they're a little more tolerant toward some others who don't agree with them. Still, it's not easy to stand firm for truth and righteousness. Still, such a stand for truth and righteousness is not really appreciated. And what about the future? We expect a still further fulfillment of Revelation 13, verses 16 and 17. And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, and that no man might buy or sell save he that had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Now, we can't be really sure or dogmatic as to the details about how this future fulfillment will come about, in just what way and to just what extent. But we note little things. Even today, as tolerant as the world seems to be, the doctrine of the Trinity is a subject on which there's very little tolerance. You find large groups of so-called Christians who have no tolerance at all for anyone who rejects the doctrine of the Trinity. This could come about as a result of some international crisis, or it could come about as a result of economic conditions in the world that the image of the beast would become involved in and to stand separate from would bring persecution. We watch for developments involving the nations and the churches. Meanwhile, how can we prepare ourselves for a severe trial if it should come in the future to us? Well, can you look ahead and say, well, I imagine it's going to come about this way, and if this happens, this is what I'm going to do? We don't think you can prepare for it that way. There's only one way you can prepare for it, and we believe it's the same way the three Hebrews prepared for their experience. They didn't wait till the day of this festival that Nebuchadnezzar made and then decide what they're going to do, but they made obedience to God a way of life for 20 years and more. The only way we can prepare for such an experience is to make it a way of life, to be faithful in the little everyday experiences of life as they arise. That's just a normal thing for us to do when we recognize what God's will in the matter. Well, there's our decision. That's what we're going to do, regardless of the consequences. We can prepare for it by diligently studying the truth and making it so familiar that we'll recognize any deviation from the principles of the truth, and so we won't be overcome by some deception. We can prepare by avoiding the spirit of Christendom, the spirit of sectarianism and bondage. And above all, the best way we can prepare is to watch and pray. We cannot prepare in our own strength. We have no doubts that the three Hebrews were men of prayer. Daniel, we know, was a man of prayer. It's stated so very clearly. And the three Hebrews, being close associates of Daniel and under his guidance and leadership for all those years, we were sure were men of prayer. And we think this had much to do with their being able to stand faithful in this time of their trial. We like to emphasize that we can't prepare for some future great or difficult experience by deciding ahead of time what we're going to say or what we're going to do if certain things happen. They're probably not going to happen in the way we imagine it. And when it does happen, whatever happens, if that's the way we've been preparing, we're going to be taken by surprise and be totally unprepared. So instead of looking ahead and trying to visualize a given situation, let's prepare by day, placing our trust in the Lord, becoming very familiar with His instructions, obeying those instructions in all the little affairs of life, and then going forth willingly, suffering for righteousness when called upon to do so, diligently serving the Lord with whatever opportunities we have, and giving thanks to Him for His overruling power on our behalf in all our affairs. We thank You.